The following broadcast of the Penn State Forum was recorded September 1st, 2006.
I'm Katie O'Toole from the College of Communications. And on behalf of the Faculty Staff Club and our sponsor, the Penn State Bookstore, I'd like to welcome all of you here today to the Nittany Lion Inn. And that includes those of you here for lunch and our listeners on WPSU FM radio and anyone who may be tuning in via the web. Today kicks off the 11th season of the Penn State Forum. And as we head into our second decade, I'd like to acknowledge the efforts and energy of the Forum Committee and the Faculty Staff Club and the steadfast support of the Penn State Bookstore. And most of all, the thought-provoking speakers who come from around the nation and beyond to share their expertise and ideas. So a very special welcome to today's guest, Derek Smith, the CEO of ChoicePoint. Before we begin today, a reminder that our next Forum presentation will be on Thursday, September 14th. When our guest will be James Broadhurst, the chairman and CEO of Eaton Park, and he's also the vice chair of Penn State's Board of Trustees. The title of his presentation is Making Smiles While Building a Business. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Penn State President Dr. Graham Spanier.
Thank you, Katie, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us as we kick off another successful an informative year of the Penn State Forum, a series that not only gives you food for your body, but also gives you food for thought. Today, we have with us a Penn State alumnus and former Nittany Lion wide receiver, who is also head of a firm that last year generated revenues of more than $1 billion. Derek Smith is chief executive officer and chairman of ChoicePoint, a company probably best known as the leading provider of data and information to government and businesses. Odds are, if you're applying for a loan or seeking insurance, ChoicePoint is helping to verify your information. ChoicePoint also provides direct marketing and forensic DNA services. In fact, following 9/11, the forensic technology arm of ChoicePoint helped to identify the remains of victims from that terrorist attack. Mr. Smith is an advocate for the responsible use of information and believes that information, biometrics, DNA, and data analytics can be used successfully to combat terrorism, child abuse, and crime. For example, over a three-year period, ChoicePoint found more than 86,000 people with undisclosed criminal convictions applying to work with children or other at-risk populations. Last year, Mr. Smith appeared before a congressional committee to discuss how ChoicePoint could do more to protect consumer privacy. A security breach that occurred when identity thieves posed as legitimate businesses led ChoicePoint and other data information services to institute procedures to protect private data from thieves. Mr. Smith supports legislation that imposes stringent penalties for the misuse of personal information, and he is driven by a desire to create a safer society through the use of technology. Under his guidance, ChoicePoint has forged relationships with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. In addition, following Hurricane Katrina, ChoicePoint also helped provide background screenings of volunteers and workers, aided in the relocation of victims, and helped to identify those lost to the storm. ChoicePoint clients include Fortune 1000 companies, financial institutions, nearly 8,000 law enforcement agencies, and community organizations such as Boy Scouts and Girl Scout Clubs of America. Mr. Smith, who earned his Penn State degree in computer science, is the author of two books on privacy. He also holds a master's degree in industrial management from Georgia Tech. Today, he will discuss Risk Revolution, the dangerous and growing gap between technology and human insight. Please join me in welcoming back to Penn State, Derek Smith.
Thank you, President Spanier. It really is a great honor for me to be back here. It's only the second time I've been back in almost 30 years. And I can't believe it now, and just I've had such a warm welcome and such great memories that I'm just thrilled to be here. I was going to start today with a joke, but my son, who happens to be with me here today, said, "Daddy, you are the worst joke teller in the world, so you will spare everybody that agony if you just get started." Let's see. Is that... There we go. One of the great blessings of my business career was an introduction many years ago to a gentleman by the name of Dr. Mike Cammie. Dr. Cammie is now 85 years old, but was the chief strategic planner for Mr. Watson Sr. when IBM was in its developmental years, and ultimately was described by Peter Drucker as the best strategic planner that he'd ever met. And one of the times that Mike and I were sitting down, he talked to me about the importance of understanding the human and the human's ability to deal with technology, and that it was something that as a CEO driving a new age technology company might be more important to me than any other thing I could deal with in my business career. It's amazing to me really how prophetic I think Dr. Cammie was during that period of time. And he's worked with me to try to ensure that while we still develop and improve the technological infrastructure of our business, we understand the human impact that technology has on you and me and people across the globe. So today, what I really want to address with you is the concept of technology, and because this is kind of the opening football weekend, I changed it versus kind of human understanding. Because it really is a battle, and I will tell you, it's a growing battle that all of us are going to have to participate in, and at least to date, many of us are losing. So in that conversation, and really, which occurred many years ago, I tried to take a look at what is technology really driving when it impacts you and me in literally our daily lives. And I'd like to start with kind of by kind of raising some questions that I'd like you to think about in the course of the next 20 or 25 minutes. The first one is the world really riskier? Do we really live in a riskier place? Do we just better understand the risks we live in? Has technology in many ways created a very unsettled society? An unsettled society at the human instinct level as to how we carry out our daily lives? And I'd like you to question and kind of go with me for a few minutes about this, what I'll call emerging conflict between the escalating power of technology and our ability as human beings to deal with and understand and respond to that increasing capability of technology. And then I want to kind of conclude by bringing it back to a specific topic and ask you, is security really a threat to privacy? And kind of my view in the key issues as it relates to national security, privacy, and kind of the information challenges that we have. So let me start by really saying that I think over the last 30 or 40 years, the real challenge for all of us as technology has become increasingly sophisticated is that there are two fundamental things that are driving the behavior and the actions that we need to deal with. The first is the whole area of the compression of time. Everything happens faster. It doesn't matter what part of your life that you're looking at, the compression of time, things that took a year now take 6 months. Things that took 6 months take a day. And literally things that used to take hours or minutes are done instantaneously. This has impact beyond what you may imagine or contemplate when that compression continues to its extraordinary and exponential march. We have to respond as human beings much faster, much quicker than ever before. The second part, though, is that while we've all discussed change and the implications of change, the fact that the amplitude of change is dramatically different also creates an interesting dilemma or phenomenon for all of us to deal with in our various challenges. And when you put them together, you realize that as technology has advanced, time's been compressed and yet the volatility of change has increased. Never would anybody have believed that a Fortune 10 company like Exxon could literally be out of business in a matter of weeks, but it happened. And those a company like Arthur Andersen, one of the great accounting firms, literally gone overnight. Those kinds of challenges that have been created by this compression of time and this amplitude of change really impact all of us in how we deal with our various lives and the decisions that we have to make. So what it means is, from a risk management standpoint, that the world we live in is far more unpredictable than it's ever been before. And as scientists, many of us go, well, let's find a new risk model. Let's find a new way to project what this new unpredictability is, and therefore find some kind of mental or emotional control over it. Yet I would argue that this is not a technological problem. In fact, it's a problem of our abilities as human beings to deal with some of these challenges. So essentially, I believe technology has changed the very nature of risk itself, and that change is going to continue to escalate. And as I'll describe later on, your biggest challenge and my biggest challenge is how to deal on a human level with this advancing and growing gap that's going to be created. So if that's true for a minute, and you may or may not agree with that, let's take a look at what that means in some ways from a safety, a security standpoint, or how we really deal with some of the issues that Maslow created at kind of those base level of our human needs. The first is, I'd like you to think about for a moment the speed of transportation. For almost all of human history, people walked, and they moved extraordinarily slowly. In just the recent past, we were able to advance transportation speeds and approach 200, 300 miles an hour. And clearly, if you look at the space shuttle, it goes at tremendous speeds. But that's not really the key to the speed of transportation. Literally, as an individual, you and I now can be anywhere in the world and gone again in 24 hours. Never in human history has that ever been true. And so we have to deal with a world now that, in fact, is highly mobile. And in fact, you can be anywhere at any time. Add to that a second component. And that's what I call the communication revolution. Historically, it took days. It was a very long and complicated process to get information from one person to another, or from one site to another. That evolved over time to where you were was important in terms of your ability to get information. Today, you can be anywhere at any time and receive instantaneous communication. It's fascinating to me walking down the streets of Penn State here. There are more people on their cell phone talking to other people somewhere else, I think, on the campus, all right, than they are talking to each other, which is an obviously very distinct phenomenon than when I was here and went to school. No longer where you are is really dependent upon your ability to communicate. And by the way, when you can communicate instantaneously like that, you can move tremendous amounts of resources. So not only can you be anywhere in the world at any point in time, you can be instantaneously communicating with anybody else, and you have the power to mobilize, transfer, and or utilize tremendous amounts of resources and or financial capacity. Add a third part, the power to destroy. For again, from the early times of human history, most violence was done with your hands, or certainly done in a combat standpoint of a one-on-one environment. Gradually, we became more sophisticated, or unfortunately did, depending upon your view, where we created armies, and armies were able to mobilize, and the nation state was able to be protected by large, expensive, and highly sophisticated armies. Today, the power to destroy is in the hands of a single individual. Now, you can call them terrorists. And that may be the true on the global scale, but somebody that kidnaps your child is a terrorist. Someone who takes and steals your financial resources is somebody who's terrorizing you at the place where you happen to be at the time. So individuals now are capable of mass devastation, destruction, or causing you physical violence or financial harm in a way that before only very organized, very powerful, very well-financed either organizations or nation states had to do. Think about that for a minute. You can be anywhere in the world and gone again. You can have instantaneous communication. You can mobilize tremendous amounts of resources, and now you have the power as an individual to create risk or devastation, destruction that only major nation states in the world used to be able to do. That's a world in which many of us are unfamiliar and, quite frankly, cause us great concern because we don't know necessarily what to do. Let me add a fourth one, which I think is emerging and really one of the powerful trends in the whole area of risk mitigation and risk management. That is what I call the death of place. And let me just ask you briefly for a moment, what are some of the places that, in fact, where you are has historically mattered? Anybody? Think for a moment, and then here's one, the home. Think of how much historically the lives of people were centered around the home. And yet today, how little activity in so many places. Our homes have become hotel rooms, apartments. They've become places in which we transmit or transfer to and out of. But they don't form the basis of the societal unit that they did historically. How about another one that you're a little bit more familiar with? School. And while this is a tremendous facility, and I believe one of the real great challenges of academia is to continue, quite frankly, in a world of electronics and technology to ensure that, in fact, the physical place where you are does matter. Because when you write, and I'll talk about emails in a few minutes, but when you write an email, I can't really read into that your expression, your emotion. I don't necessarily understand all that goes through it. And there is a physical connectivity in learning that's still important. You still take advantage of great knowledge and be able to do electronic learning, but it is very important. But yet today, the number of people who attend online opportunities, I think I checked it out the other day. If you put online degrees into the internet search engine, you get over somewhere between 40 and 50 million responses. Think about that. Yet for almost all of human history, school was a critical place for you to be. How about your religious organization? For the most part, much of our lives were built around going to some part of a religious facility as part of our upbringing or part of our daily activity. Today, 82 million people have an online relationship with some kind of a church. So that our homes in some ways are less important to us. The school, which was the center of our activity, is now becoming, again, increasing vulnerable to the electronic challenges of technology. And our religious and similar type institutions also no longer have that centered place where place is important. And now it's really created even a broader phenomenon, which is nations no longer can use their geographic boundaries to be able to create philosophical, religious, or some type of control over the intellectual capabilities of its citizens. And so it's a great challenge for people, and one of the reasons why I believe we do live in a very unsettled world is that before you could use geography to keep your ideas or your ideals or how you believe life should be lived within a certain geographic parameter. It simply can't be done today because of technology. And so think about this for a moment. Do we live in an unsettled society? Are you in some ways unsettled on a regular basis? Well, if we can have people that can be anywhere in the world at any time with perfect and instant communication, the ability to mobilize mass resources, have the ability to create devastation and destruction, and the fact that place is no longer relevant, And those boundaries that have kept us as a civilized society in some ways isolated have been broken down. I would suggest that that's a challenge that most of us on the individual and human level really have not been able to come to grips with. And so I believe that the greatest challenge facing humanity right now is what I call this growing and accelerated gap between technological innovation and advancement and our ability as human beings to understand and interpret. Technology is going up on an exponential level, and we grow and learn really on a genetic level. And it takes generations and generations for a lot of that knowledge and learning level really to become part of our daily society. And so as we see technology continue to advance, you can see the human emotion side, whether in some cases it's just uncertainty or in other cases it grows to anger or to rage. Our ability to deal with a lot of the sociological implications of technology are really at the forefront of a lot of the frustrations and challenges that we really have. Now, that doesn't mean for any one particular point you may be anywhere on that particular curve. And I could, we could go through, and I don't have the time to go, but you could plot where is something heading on a specific topic. I'm going to take a couple and go through just to give you a little insight into, you know, different areas of our, of how you and I interact daily to try to get you a feel for it. But I think the real, point I'd like you to take away from it is, if as technologists, you aren't really spending a lot of time dealing with the human implications of the technology developing, you are missing what's going to be the critical decision factor going forward. And if you are people that that tend to deal with the humanities or the liberal arts side of society, and you don't understand the marching advance of technology, you are going to become obsolete in your ability to communicate and present your message and really make a change to society. And yet, most places, we haven't been able to bring the knowledge together. We haven't been able to create the divide. We talk in different languages. We communicate in different ways. And the implications of that across the broad spectrum of society are growing, and they are considerable. Let's take a couple of examples. How about the media? Now, when you look at the media, you can see that really it's a question of what's important, right? As a citizen now, as an individual, you've got to decide with everything going on in the world what is important. Yet look at the tremendous amount of different mechanisms in which you can get information to help you decide what's going on in the world. Let's take a couple of them, all right? How about mainstream media, right? If something happens at noon right now, savvy news consumers know it. Their BlackBerries or some other type of electronic device goes off, and you know about it almost instantaneously. And yet by the time you sit down for dinner or get home, it's been the topic of news commentators, discussion, dialogue, etc. 10 or 20 years ago, there's only 3 news networks. Now I've got on my own system access to at least 24. Now what's interesting about that is that now, historically, when we were looking at the news, what you got was, for the most part, facts. The news reported to you facts. Didn't matter what station you listened to. What followed the facts was kind of an analysis, a commentary around those, and then ultimately you ended up with some kind of either social policy or discussion or whatever down the road. Today, what technology has done is that it's actually caused the entire process to be reversed. Today, you get the commentary first, then you get the analysis, and then if you're paying attention and you still have interest, you get the facts. How many of you thought they solved the JonBenet Ramsey case? Right? All you heard was villain, you know, terrible person, you know, we found this person that killed this poor young girl. Yet if you listen, a lot of the stories and the facts really didn't make any sense. But that didn't matter. We had to get the news out immediately, and so what you got was a wealth of commentary that ultimately turned down into a set of facts. That is the exact opposite of the way historically we went about understanding, interpreting news. And it doesn't matter whether you believe it's the left side or the right side in terms of the dissemination. The reason, you know, Fox News, fair and balanced. I always thought facts were always fair and balanced. Commentary's not fair and balanced necessarily, all right? And so we've changed the whole way. Technology's changed media. But not just broadcast media. What about the average citizen? Do you know now that there are 50 million blogs that are out there? 50 million. And there's a forecast that'll actually get to 100 million. Now, at some point, you run, you know, the mathematics and it can't continue to double. But that's a phenomenal thing. 50 million people. Now, who's reading that stuff? Who's got time to spend and sort through 50 million different people's opinions? I don't know. But somebody's doing it. Somebody's writing that. Now, interestingly enough, in our business, I've made it clear that if you send me an email, that I am not psychologically obligated to read it. Yet in today's world, most people believe you send an email, not only should you read it, but I deserve a response, and I deserve a response right now. And so you think about the unbelievable amount of input that comes in from this wide variety of places, and there is a tremendous expectation that you're going to respond and respond to it right now. Well, who's decided that that is important to me or that that's where I should spend my time? It's a tremendous challenge for you and I to deal with. People have an expectation of a response. I'm trying to sort how I deal with that, and there's not a very easy solution to it unless you really set down, you know, a very serious set of rules. How about some of the great new websites that are out there? Two of the most popular, MySpace and YouTube. Are you familiar with those? Almost everybody on a college campus is familiar with MySpace. It's become literally one of the most popular websites out there. But as President Spanier said, ChoicePoint runs one of the largest pre-employment screening companies in the country. You know, now many employers actually look on MySpace to determine what you've written there before they decide to offer college graduates a job. How many college students are going, what I'm writing on there may be read someday, and that may be used, all right, in order to evaluate whether I get an ongoing job? What you write in cyberspace is basically put there in perpetuity. You cannot find a way to bring it back. YouTube, at least at the last report, claimed to have more people. What YouTube is, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's a website where you can post a video of you doing, I guess it'd be a video, anything you want, but most of them are people doing nutty and crazy and whatever kinds of things. And it's become literally far more access than any news or commentary type site. Why? Because people know how to look at a movie and they can laugh and they can use the technology to kind of forget that they don't have to use all their intellectual capacity to go through this world of cyberspace to decide what's true, what's right, what's accurate, what's important to me. And so they've gone back to watch cartoons. The number one thing, YouTube, is essentially a cartoon. So you've got a cartoon on one side, and you've got this, in essence, resume service in MySpace that you're putting out. And, you know, I don't recall, particularly with my son here, what I did while I was on campus so many years ago. But I would really like to advance the world, you know, 15 years from now and watch a Supreme Court justice nomination when they pull out everything that that person has written on cyberspace for the last. Now they search through these obscure journals and writings and et cetera. The truth of the matter is we are putting out, again, for perpetuity, an incredible amount of information, all right? I mean, the real challenge is how does a person decide? Again, very quickly. If you think about those blogs, look at this. The reality is now that people in mainstream media are going to the blogs to get information. They admit the fact the information may not even be right. Yet they turn around, use the information, turn it into the mainstream, and what happens is you can get an obtuse fact somewhere in the world, put on a blog, picked up by a mainstream journalist, brought into the mainstream, you see it, you hear it, you believe it, and suddenly now everybody's become, in essence, a journalist. That's not bad. What's bad is, how do we as human beings separate out who's got commentary versus facts versus our ability to interpret all that? It's an increasingly tough challenge. It's also true for government. I would argue to you that today we have tremendous political leaders who understand social policy, and we have a lot of, not as many in government, but some that understand technology. We have almost nobody that understand social policy, who are writing the laws and regulations, that also understand technology and implications of technology. So as soon as we get the law written, which takes a long, long time, technology's obsoleted the law and it is no longer, for the most part, representative of what it intended to do. We were victims in part of a data breach that happened over 18 months ago. Today, there still is no federal legislation enacted around the whole area of security breaches and how we deal with it. Why? It's complicated. It's not easy. But on the other hand, we have very few people that can kind of bridge that gap. Quickly, let me just go through a couple things. So when you deal with the whole area of privacy and security, we have this same kind of phenomenon. You as an individual want to be able to self-manage and understand your information, and yet technology is putting that information out into more and more places, which in some cases for you creates great economic freedom and value, and other cases, you know, you may consider it a threat. You can see here where David Brin said, you know, we all want privacy for ourselves, but accountability for everybody else, right? I'm okay, but you're not. And again, I don't know whether, you know, tomorrow they'll be signing up for T-shirts at a football game or not, but you look at that. People say, I want a T-shirt, I'll tell you everything you want to know about me, and then they'll go home and say, wait a minute, my privacy's being breached. Who's got this information? What's it being used for? It's an interesting dichotomy as to how we're operating as citizens. Well, why is that? All right? I think for the most part, the discussion about privacy is really not about the logical, but in many cases, it's about the emotional. And I would argue that from a consumer standpoint, this is what I believe you should care about. All right? One is that you have visibility in the whole world of information and databases. What goes on? How does it work? How is that being information being used? To whom is it being given? Take the mystery out of it. The truth is that there's no reason why you shouldn't know at all times how your information is being used, by whom, for what purposes, and what value either you or society gets from it. So let's create visibility. The second part is you want control. It's interesting. If I give you the information for the T-shirt, it's okay. If the person who's giving out the T-shirt gets it by themselves and you don't have control over it, you ultimately feel threatened. So we got to find more and more mechanisms to create control. And third, we have to respect the individual consumer and citizen through the use of that information. And I would tell you that if, in fact, that we can show you visibility, and you should demand visibility into the processes of which data and information is being used. If you can have more and more control over that and you feel respected by the people that participate in the world of data, information, and technology, then in fact, security and privacy are very compatible. And in fact, we can't really create a safer, more secure America unless we create one that is sensitive to how the information is used, where it's used, and how. And that can be done. And it does not involve, I don't believe there's almost any place where we have to trade off privacy for security. So if that's true, then what's the real issue? Well, I would argue that the real discussion shouldn't be about privacy. It should be about anonymity. While I believe you have the absolute right to privacy, and we should give you transparency or visibility and control and respect, in a free society, when you want the rights and privileges of that free society, you cannot be anonymous. And so you can opt out. You don't have to participate in certain parts of society, but when you do, then you owe it to the other citizens or people of that society to let them know who you are, so there could be a determination made as whether or not there's a fundamental threat or a fundamental risk. And as President Spanier said before, this to me is personal, because we have been involved in situations. All right, we brought back over 800 missing or kidnapped children by the use of information technology that was used appropriately and responsibly. Nothing's worse. One was a two-day-old baby that was kidnapped from the hospital. As a parent, can you imagine coming into the room and realize you've just lost your child, but we're able to bring that child back within 48 hours, safe and unharmed? Every 43 minutes, a convicted sex felon registers to work with a youth-oriented organization. Every 43 hours, at least under the choice point screening processes. So you can imagine what that is in terms of just what the global really numbers are. Anonymous people, people who aren't who they say they are, pose a threat. We're involved in the bombings last year in London, where we're able to tie people's identities together to better understand who posed a threat then to the British society. And we were fortunate enough to be involved with the Maryland State Police to help bring back to find and locate the snipers in Washington, D.C. In all of those circumstances, it wasn't about privacy. It wasn't invading somebody's information. It was about a simple question. Who are you? Why are you here? And should society give you that privilege to be able to conduct whatever, either responsibility, job, or freedoms that you might have? We don't have to trade off security for privacy. What we have to do is ensure that we don't let anonymity become a substitute for privacy. But for me, all of this really comes down, this whole battle of anonymity, really to one thing. And you know, what I have in my hand here is a very special tube, and you're all blessed here at Penn State to have Bob Shaler. Bob, would you stand up for a minute, please? Bob was part, he led the New York City forensic team following the tragedy of 9/11. And I can tell you, I have incredible great respect for himself and the people that he led during that period of time. But they would send us tubes just like this, ultimately close to 30,000 of them that contain individual bone samples from the World Trade Center disaster to our DNA laboratories in Virginia. And I had the really chilling experience one day of walking into our special refrigerated rooms. We called it the bone room, because in that room were the remains of the people that tragically died that day. I walked in as one individual, I left as somebody else. You couldn't be in that room without understanding, again, at a human level, what this is really all about. We can debate the emotional. We can debate how to use technology. But in the end, it comes down to people. It came down to people that lost loved ones. It came down to people that, quite honestly, and one of the things that was so important in the DNA analysis, and I think, Bob, if I'm not right, 1,800, 1,900 people, you were able to identify who they were through DNA technology. They wanted an essence of their loved one that they could put to rest. It was a phenomenally emotional experience. I never want to have to walk into one of those rooms again, ever. And I want to make sure that as an individual dealing in a technological world, that I understand at the human level what it takes in our society for us to use technology so that people can operate freely and without threat of government surveillance or intervention, but at the same time understand that in today's high-risk world where you can be anywhere with perfect communications, the power to destroy, and no longer our ability to protect us by where we are, that anonymity is no longer an option. We can't let it happen. And so I hope that what we'll do is get away from the emotional, get away from the rhetoric, and realize we can protect the individual's right to privacy. We can also protect your safety and security There isn't the trade-off that's necessary that we all spend so much time debating. And if we simply say, I need to know who you are and whether I can extend this right or privilege to you in this society, that we can end up having the balance and fairness across the spectrum that all of us need and deserve and are going to have if we're going to continue to live in a free democratic society that we so much value. Thank you very much, and I'll be glad to answer any of the questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll begin with what is potentially the most awkward question with your son here and get that one out of the way.
Okay.
Our children now spend more time than ever emailing, instant messaging, cell calling, and playing video games. Arguably, children are spending less time with their parents. What implications do you see technology having on the parent-child relationship?
Well, that's an absolutely fantastic question. I think it's a very, very significant change. In some ways, you know, it's negative. In some ways, it's positive. Let me take the positive first, and that is that I had, a daughter that's now a senior in college, and the reality is that through technology and emailing and cell phones, I've got a closer relationship to her now than I ever did with my parents when it was much more difficult for us to communicate. So in that particular case, it's allowed a connectivity and a relationship to continue with her that would not have existed without really today's robust instant communication environment. Now, where I think it becomes very dangerous is when you haven't already built up that relationship to where you can use that technology now to, in essence, enhance your relationship. So if, in fact, particularly during those formative years, it used to be parents had 18 years or so before their child really left home and left to go to college and et cetera. Now the truth of the matter is you've probably got 8 to 10 years in which you can interact and create that set of values before a technological environment or changes in society have taken over and no longer is the main influence of that child the parent. And so I believe that we have to find better ways to force human interaction, all right? That we hide behind too much technology, that in fact it's easy, and the real emotions and the real challenges we face and the real relationships that we have can't really ultimately develop and grow simply through an electronic world. And if we use that in lieu of the human touch, then we're going to find ourselves, I believe anyway, as a society that really struggles with what ultimately is important, which is the values and the principles and the way in which, you know, we really live and deal with our daily lives. It's a tremendous challenge. And for parents, it's easy. You know, sometimes you believe that it's the babysitting service or it's the alternative for you having to spend the time. And again, you talk about the gap, particularly there's a lot of parents that don't want to be technologically literate. And so they're not capable of dealing with that kind of interaction technologically. So I believe, you know, that we need to spend more time one-on-one in a human relationship, less time electronically. Use the electronics where it's necessary, but don't use it as a substitution for our ability to want to grapple with the challenges or problems that we have. How'd I do, 10?
That wasn't so bad, no. I agree that we don't need to trade off privacy for anonymity, assuming that those using the information do so in an ethical manner. But how do we control for those who misuse the information?
Well, I think there's no doubt that if people misuse information, that we need to have, just as we do any other place in society, laws and regulations and penalties that deal with people that consciously, maliciously, and purposely misuse information. The reality is that nobody is safe from certain types of information security and cybersecurity attacks. But if you have intentionally or maliciously misused the information, then we need to be a society that deals with that. One of the things I'm very proud of at Choice Point is, in this age where you've heard a lot about data breaches and security implications, to the best of my knowledge, we are the only ones that prosecuted and the person is in jail for accessing our information. And until we make it a much stronger penalty, not only for the people that, if they did it maliciously as a company, but the reverse is we have to have a much better sense of punishment for people that actually take, steal, misuse that information. It's a crime, and unfortunately, too many times, you know, we don't put the penalties behind it that is necessary and is required.
Would you recommend that students in art and humanities curricula be required to take additional math and physics courses to bridge their gap between human interest and growing technologies?
The answer to that is absolutely, but it works both ways. All right? That I think the people, probably even the tougher challenge is to get the technology people to really take more of the humanities type of an education. It scares the living daylights out of them. All right? They love to hide behind whatever it is, hide behind screens, hide behind, you know, terminals and communication networks and whatever. And it's frightening. When they have to go face-to-face and really talk to somebody, it's a very difficult thing to do. So I think it's true on both parts. And I think, you know, this is a great place for Penn State to lead the way, that absolutely you should not be able to get an education unless you have thoroughly understand not only technology as it relates to your discipline, if you're not in a technological world, and if you are, if you can't relate that to a real-world practical application on a human level, then you shouldn't be allowed outside the door. And that's not the way it works today. I understand that. But it would be incredibly important. And I believe that you would do and we as an institution here would do a great service. Because as soon as you get out in the real world, that's what happens. Okay? It's about who uses the technology now and what implication does it have. And I think it's a great opportunity, but I think it's also a tremendous challenge.
What are the implications of the 24/7 news cycle for democratic government, which depends on an informed citizenry?
You've got to, in that case, I think all of us have to ask ourselves, what's an informed citizenry? All right? I believe that that's absolutely correct. But with all this bombardment of different sources and different evaluations and different commentaries, I think the challenge for us is to decide, how do we get our news? How do we get the information that allows us to make those kinds of decisions? And for each of us, that may ultimately be different. But I think that you've got to be able to separate and ask yourself, when you're in this 24/7 world, how much of this is information being told to you because it's somebody else's view, and they're in essence to try to persuade you that their view is correct, or how much of it is really factual information being relayed to you that you then have to sit down and decide and interpret and understand. Now, one of the challenges there is you got to be willing to do that, right? You can give that as a surrogate, which most people do today. X is a surrogate. My political party is a surrogate, right? My religious philosopher is a surrogate. We have, as a society, because it continues to bombard us, end up picking surrogates and saying, I'm going to listen to the surrogate, and they're going to tell me how to think and what to do. And I would suggest to you that while that may be expedient, I'm not sure that that's necessarily healthy. And so if we're an informed citizenry, great. If what we're really being is an influenced and kind of preached to society, I think we got to go back again to what's the real humanity that the technology is being used for. And I believe in people across the world, but particularly the American people, are very bright. And if you set the facts to them and give them a chance to understand it, they may not agree. But they're very, very good. But most of them, and I won't challenge you, but I could give you some examples, that you'll have an opinion of something, and then I will ask you to tell me the factual information underneath it, and very few will be able to do it. But you'll have a very strong opinion. You're going to care a lot about it, and you're even liable to vote based on it. But you have no idea, factually, where the information came from, whether it's true, and how you came about making that opinion.
What is the most important information about protecting privacy while using technology that we should share with our students?
I guess that's a very interesting question. I guess when you talk about privacy and information sharing, twofold. First is, I think you should reevaluate or talk to people about just what they're putting out there. There's a lot of uses of the internet and technology and emails and MySpace and the like that I don't think anybody truly understands what the electronic trail that you're leaving as part of your individual life. And while you may think that database companies or whatever, okay, are the threat to privacy, and not that they're not important and shouldn't be understood and regulated and overseen, you are putting out, your friends are putting out, your associates are putting out an incredible vast network of information that over time, no one's going to know whether you said it, whether somebody else said it about you, and that eventually you're going to have to defend. And the lawyer's dream has been the internet. There are more lawyers that have spent more time combing through emails and internet traffic in order to find things that they can then use or interpret from a legal environment than you could ever imagine. And so I guess what I would say is start with yourself and understand from a privacy standpoint what are you putting out there and why are you doing it and how is it being used and who are you communicating it with, and then come back and say, now, what do I need to do personally? And from that standpoint, I believe all people should monitor your own information. I encourage all of you in this world of identity theft and you know, potential illegal or inappropriate access to the information, it is ultimately your responsibility. And that you should find ways to monitor your credit report. You should look at information about yourself. And you need to proactively manage your world of information so someone else isn't managing it for you.
Recently, an executive at Google stated, "We are not scanning books for humans to read, but for artificial intelligence to read. Will the day come when we need to be wary of advances in artificial intelligence?"
Well, I hope the day comes when we have to be wary of human intelligence more than artificial intelligence. You know, again, I think you have to realize that, you know, technology is amoral, right? It's neither good nor bad. It's what human beings do with the technology that ultimately define its characteristic and its nature. So I'm far more concerned about how we're creating a society that uses technology than I am just the technology for technology itself. I mean, the leader of Iran has his own blog. All right, now that is a phenomenal thing to take place. And so we need to recognize that in this society, it's not the machines that are going to do it to us, which is really the answer to your question. I don't believe the real threat is that technology is going to take over and some artificial environment is somehow going to create a world that ultimately creates a threat of devastation, destruction, or inappropriate or impropriety. It's people. And that's the message I'm really trying to deliver, that we spend so much time and we're so proud of our technology. What I want to see the next future leaders of this world be able to do is to bridge that gap. I want someone to be able to understand the human side of technology, but also understand what the capabilities of technology is or the threats that are there. Most technology makes our life better. It's tremendous. I'm not in any way, I believe technology is fantastic. But we have to understand the human implications. So I believe the bigger threat is the human misuse of the technology, not that the technology will take over and misuse humanity.
What kind of information do you use to catch a sex offender or a terrorist?
Well, it's not our responsibility to catch sex offenders or terrorists. So the reality is we provide information to law enforcement agencies or governmental agencies that really assist them in being able to do it. So what I would say to that is, as it relates to how information is used to, particularly in the area of terrorism, I believe in something called link analytics. One of the big debates that's going on today is, you know, should we create profiles of people, statistical evaluations to help us limit the population of people that we need to look at, review, or... And clearly, there are people that are very concerned about that and what the implications from a societal human standpoint are. I don't favor that approach. I favor something called link analytics, which says if we have a known piece of data, could be a social security number that's been used inappropriately, it could be a telephone number, it could be a contact of where somebody worked, that you start with an individual element that you know and can defend its purpose and reality, and then, in fact, you expand out. So you start with a piece of data, and then you start linking other data to it to create kind of an information network that will help law enforcement. What you don't do is, you know, basically create a huge haystack. And we're all looking for needles in a haystack when we're looking for criminals or we're looking for terrorists or whatever. Well, by putting more data on top of it, all you're doing is putting more hay on top of the stack. And it really doesn't help solve the problem. But if you can find data, and I would argue that, let's take, you know, a very personal part, a Social Security number. If you walked up to an airline counter and somebody told you, I've got to delay you on this flight because your Social Security number has been linked to terrorism, your first reaction, assuming you're not a terrorist, okay, is that, oh my gosh, how could this be? I got to get on the flight. This is inappropriate. This is wrong. I've been, you know, unjustly accused or detained. But if you really step back, they just told you something that's incredibly valuable to you, that your Social Security number is now out there being used for something other than what you know it's being used for. And the sooner you understand that and the sooner that you deal with that, the easier your life is going to be, and you may avoid something that's far more serious than a delay at the airport as a result of that information you just got. That's very different than somebody saying, I create a profile, you look or act like X, and therefore we're going to detain you, even though I know there's a 90-something percent probability it's probably not you. So I'm a strong believer in using data and analytics for link technology, where I can always describe to you, go back to visibility, control, and respect. I'll tell you why I stopped you. I'll tell you why I have a problem. And then either it's legitimate and we'll have to, you know, society will deal with that, or if it's not, then you should have recourse and an ability to get it fixed and get it changed in today's world.
Where do you come down on the domestic wiretapping controversy?
Well, I don't, I'm going to answer that in a very different way. One, we weren't involved, and I really don't know a lot about the intricacies of that, you know, particular circumstance and situation. But what I will tell you from an interesting standpoint, going back to this whole issue of technology and human insight, is that we've spent all of our time trying to decide whether the executive branch has certain powers or whether or not the legislative branch has certain powers. And I'm not sure we're ever going to solve that from a pure legal standpoint, because clearly there's at least enough ambiguity to make both sides believe strongly that they're correct. But what we didn't do was to sit down and say, now, since we don't really know or we're not really sure, and I realize not everybody would agree with that statement, but the reality is we now have new technology that those laws really weren't set out to understand and deal with. And so what we should be doing is going, do we need to rewrite a law? Do we need to relook at how we do this? And bring back the fact that it's a new technological world dealing with still real human instincts of fear or governmental powers. But what we're not doing is sitting back and going, well, here's what could happen, so here's what we have to change, and then get Congress or get the executive branch to come together and clearly write new policy. That's what I think needs to happen. But instead, what we do is we go back, and that's not to say anybody should be above the law or that anybody violated the law, so I don't want to be mischaracterized. But the truth is that debate is going to go on for a long time. What I care about as a citizen is, what do we really need to do in this new technological world? And if it's different than what we already have, if it isn't, then fine. But if it is, let's work together and rewrite those laws so that we can now protect ourselves on a going forward basis. And so I guess I'd feel a lot better if that was the issue we were debating, because I'm not sure the other issue is one that we're really going to be able to solve.
We have time for just one more question, but first I'm going to join you on the podium. As Han Solo, he battled the evil empire. As Indiana Jones, he matched wits with the Nazis. And this year, in the movie Firewall, Harrison Ford takes on identity theft. Do you sense that Hollywood is changing your identity from a security-conscious corporate executive to a swashbuckling superhero sex symbol?
Not yet. But I'm more than willing at any point, if anybody would like to do that, I'll be the first to stand in line and accept the responsibility. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
You have been listening to Derek Smith speak at the Penn State Forum, recorded September 1st, 2006. Copies of the forum are available by calling Media Sales toll-free at 1-800-770-2111. That number again, 1-800-770-2111. This has been a production of Penn State Public Media.